There we go. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. A very warm welcome to this first full conference day of the second Austrian Forum for Peace. My name is Damita Pressel, and I have the honor of guiding you through the conference. Let me give you a brief overview of the day before we start into our panel. So the focus for the first day is climate, peace, and security. And as you can see, we have a panel lined up on how to put the climate, peace, and security nexus into practice, after which we have several workshops planned. They'll be running in parallel from 11 to 12:30 and from 2 to 5 with a lunch break in between. You should already know which workshop, if any, you will be participating in. If you are unsure, please speak to the nice people at the registration office. And if you're uncertain regarding the room, you will find plans to guide you just outside this room right here. Lunch will be served in the courtyard at 12:30. This is irrespective of the workshop you're attending, so please grab some lunch at 12:30. If you are not busy in a workshop, at 3 p.m., we have a guided museum tour planned for you. So it's a brand new museum that opened in May, and you'll be given a tour of the highlights at 3 if you so choose to attend. The meeting point is at the museum shop, and there's a variety of exhibitions, one of which focuses on this place that we're in, Stadtschleining, and its role in peace building over the years. So if that's something you're interested in and you are not busy at a workshop, then we invite you to join us at 3. If you are busy and you cannot attend at 3 today, you'll find a ticket to the museum in your goodie bag, and you can just go and check out the exhibitions on your own time whenever you have a moment. Your workshop will end at 5, and there will be a public panel on the ongoing war in Ukraine starting at 5:30, which we hope you'll join us for. It'll be moderated by me in German, but there will be simultaneous interpretation in English available, and we have some very interesting speakers that are shown now on the presentation. Somebody reporting from Ukraine as a journalist, we have the ambassador of Switzerland to the OECD, and we have the director of the International Institute for Peace. I hope it'll be fascinating, and I hope you'll join us. For those of you who are conference guests, there will be a seated dinner served at the hotel tonight between 7 and 8. And for those of us joining externally, for external guests, we're going to offer you some snacks after the panel. And then for tonight, we have a public screening of the award-winning film The Need to Grow, which we also hope you will join us for. The conversation around climate change, I think, as we all know, can become a little bit heavy, but this film is a story of solutions. The Need to Grow follows three individuals fighting for change in the industry of agricultural food production, and the film explores the opportunities, but also the struggles of challenging the status quo and trying to find real-world solutions, which is not always easy. The film will be shown in English, but we will have German subtitles, so everyone, both our English and our German-speaking guests, should be able to follow without any issues. If you find yourself with any questions at any point, please do not hesitate to contact a member of the organizational team. We also realize, of course, that there is an important game tonight for the Austrians in the room, but also for the Turkish for our Turkish guests. Austria is playing Turkey at 9 p.m. So we will be showing that, we'll be screening that in the courtyard, and we do understand if you choose to follow that rather than the movie, which is great. So make your choice. there will be transfers back at 10, and having covered all of the organizational details, I think we're good to dive into our topic of the day, the nexus between climate, peace, and security. So as the climate crisis escalates, new challenges for peace and security emerge. Extreme weather and natural disasters not only exacerbate existing threats, but they give rise to new conflicts as well. And as such, this nexus between climate, peace, and security is now a focus of international frameworks and policies. Are these frameworks translated into action? How do affected communities experience the implementation? And how do we connect peace building with climate justice? And how can different actors contribute to this? All of those questions are the ones that we're going to aim to cover in our next panel. And to guide you through, I'm very pleased to introduce your moderator. She is the president of the Global Forum on Sustainable Energy, and she is also a board member of the Austrian Center for Peace, Irene Giener-Reichel. Please do take over.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, dear Damita, for this introduction. Yes, I'm Irene Giener-Reichl. I'm a former diplomat with the Austrian Foreign Service. And I worked a lot on issues of sustainability and on environmental issues, global environmental issues over the decades. Also, the nexus with economic development and women's rights, and so forth. And during these times, very often the connection between environmental issues and peace and security came up. The connection between water issues and peace and security came up. And obviously now as we see the progression of climate change and the effects that it has on the world, these connections come more and more to the fore of political decision making as well. Not enough in our view as of yet, but they become more and more prominent. But I remember even in the time after the wars when former Yugoslavia broke up, there were attempts also to use environmental action as a way of confidence building. I remember projects that were implemented to create cross-border nature reserves so that persons interested in maintaining and in restoring a good environment, natural environment, could work together even though they had been involved in hostilities previously. So there is a little bit that we can build on in this topic, but what we are trying to do in this conversation here is to open up the horizon a bit more, to bring in a bit more of the knowledge that is available both from the natural sciences and from the policy making around the world on this issue. And I'm very honored to moderate this panel today. I have a fabulous lineup of panelists. I will introduce them as they take the floor. Let me just very briefly give you a quick introduction to how I would like to conduct the panel. We will start out with four initial interventions by the panelists, not too long, perhaps up to 10 minutes, something like that. And we will go from the global to the more regional. I will encourage also to have interaction among the panelists if they wish to comment or elaborate on what a fellow panelist has said. And of course we want to open it up then to all of you to hear from you in the audience, our distinguished public, so that we can turn this really into a conversation that we are going to have around this topic. I would also like to distill out of our conversation, if at all possible, some recommendations or some, you know, perhaps initial insights that we can then bring to the concluding panel on Thursday. There is going to be an event where the fruits from all the individual workshops and panels are brought together somehow for the audience to hear. So without further ado, I would like to ask Professor Lucka Kaifes-Bogataj from the University of Ljubljana and a member of the UN panel on climate change. She was on that panel for many years. You remember that the IPCC also received the Nobel Prize for Peace because of the important contribution that this international group of scientists is making to development, peace, and security around the world. Please, you have the floor.
Okay, thank you. Good morning from my side as well. Thank you for opportunity to be here. I will, in my presentation, somehow set the stage That's also, you see the title, Where Do We Stand? And in my view, if we talk about environment or if we talk about peace building, we have the same problem in both areas. If we want to really understand what's going on, we have to see the pressures we are facing. That's not all. I could write much more about that, but I would like to remember you that climate change is not the only problem we have. It's important, it's irreversible, it's tragic in a way, but it's not all. Because we have interlinked connections with other things like ecosystem loss, which is also problematic. We don't feel it in some parts of the world, but pessimists say that we already irreversibly lost half of the nature. So this is a problem. Climate change and biodiversity loss, they are victims of our intense use of natural resources. So this is again connected. But why are we using so much of natural resources and producing climate change in that context? Because we have a wrong economic model. We have model of growth, but this planet does not grow. That is the problem. And of course, partial problem is also population growth, because more people need more resources. But the problem in that respect is not the number of people, but number of consumers. And this number is very low. It's 1 billion. 7.5 billion of people do not do harm yet, but the economic systems want them to push in the same mode of operation. And this is not all. Remember COVID. Who knows what comes next? So there are surprises. Science is very sure about that. We cannot define them, but to build resilience is also important. Just to give you the idea, what are the other problems really acute beside climate change? You can, of course, read it yourself. Last September, there was a very comprehensive piece of science, if I may say so, a paper showing that only in 20 years, or even less than 20 years, we actually exceeded the capacity of this planet to neutralize our behavior. And beside climate change, beside biodiversity loss, we also have problems with nitrogen cycles, which is connected to agriculture, so something has to change in the food system. We have problems with land system change. Only one species, human, Homo sapiens, took practically 90% of the land for its own need. And I warn you all about novel entities. Novel entities is not just chemical and plastics. Maybe the novel entity is also artificial intelligence, because we don't know how actually it will affect environment. Could be not in a very positive way. And we already have problems with water in the soil. So this is a really bleak picture. But when we want to solve climate change alone, without taking into account other problems, we can do harm in other fields. Remember biofuels. Biofuels were meant to push sort of a climate change problems back. But when you produce a biofuel, you need land, you need nitrogen, you need water. So you create three other problems. So when we talk about climate change, temperature increase is not the main problem. But already when you see how temperature is increasing, you can see that we are not in the same boat. We have Arctics when this change is really pronounced. We have some maybe island states where temperature increase is not the major problem. But I do not connect this picture about warming with peace problem or the peacekeeping. The other trend is crucially more important, and this is about the water. So when we talk about the water, this is already observed, we can clearly see two categories. We can see some winners, if I may call that, in blue, countries with higher temperature, but also with more water coming. But losers, and where be probably very hard to keep peaceful solutions, are those who lack water. So it's practically the whole Latin America, it's Mediterranean area, it's Australia, it's all over the world. And if you combine the population in this area to this problem, we can see that even in Europe, we will experience a lot of tensions. So beware of water, not so much about temperature. This is also the message of science. So is politics, is climate diplomacy taking these problems seriously? Unfortunately, as a scientist, I may say no. Because after the COP28, after all this science-produced evidence, also people already felt on their own life climate change in one way or another, we are not moving. We are still observing this gap between what is promised, not delivered, promised, and what it should be done. The green curve and the blue are far apart. So they sometimes say, the climate diplomats, or even Gutierrez, I remember, he said that this goal, 1.5 degrees alive, it's not alive anymore, unfortunately. We still can fight for 2 degrees, but even that, if we don't change politics in a way, because COPs are political events, not scientific ones, we are in a bad shape. So what does IPCC, when I come from, say about these impacts on peace and security? Of course, climate change contributes to the risks through food problems, through droughts, etc. But it's vice versa. Also, conflict contributes to the climate change risk. I don't want to speculate how much fossil fuels is used right now in Ukraine war or in Gaza, or at also there are 55 small wars going on. Some say that military emissions are emissions like for Russia. So 5 to 6% global, that's a lot. But we don't want to talk so much about it. But it will come worse in the future. And also what science can predict is that climate change problems will interact with other problems already present. So we will have some complex risks which cannot even be totally understood by science right now. But of course, climate change interventions can be beneficial. So whatever we do to mitigate climate change, except geoengineering, which I don't want to touch, can be beneficial and will be beneficial, but we need political will to do so. And when we talk about impacts, we can talk about developing and developed countries, but we have to bear in mind that half of the population are women. And women are really much more hurt by climate change, and climate crisis is not gender neutral. Also, young people are, but I guess that when we talk about the half of the world brain is not used in terms of fighting climate change and all that. So without pushing that agenda along climate change agenda, we will probably not achieve the right way out. So what about solutions? So far, I was just talking about problems. Well, I'm not an economist, but it is obvious. This is the elephant in the room, that economic model is the root cause of ecological problems, but probably also the social problem. It does not work in 21st century to grow 2%, 5%, or even more percent per year on the planet, which does not grow. So there are about 55, at least, models of different sort. I just point out 4 here. Because degrowth is the model, it's not a model, it's an umbrella of models that we can really maintain probably the same level of livelihood, but with much less pressures on environment and in terms of the peace building as well. We can choose post-growth, which is another model, which is maybe more transitional model. In Europe, we chose the green growth model, which is, in my view, not the best one because still implies growth. But and this is a bit illusional that we can economically grow without any more intervention into the nature. It, theoretically, yes, but in practice, it does not go. And there's also donut economics, which I personally like a lot. You can read about that. You can learn about that. You can try to put that in practice in one way or another. Another initiative, which is very concrete, and you can also learn about it, is the initiative of Club of Rome. And then this initiative actually has 5 goals, what to change, how to change, of course, quickly. We don't have much time. But actually, they are around the same ideas other researchers have. So what are these five areas? Of course, we need energy transition. That is probably clear. But we can do it slowly, or we can jump because we don't have much time. So we can start with the taxes, carbon tax, but we should end up with the new forms of energy and especially new forms of storage. Food is a problem. We are not all consumers. We can live sustainable, but each of us has to eat three times a day. So food is something that is clearly a problem regarding water. And in the center, probably, of this action is not just food wastage. This can be done now, but also how to change animal proteins to alternative proteins. Poverty. With inequality, we cannot change much. Why? Because I say very bluntly to my students, the majority of poor people cannot change anything. The minority of rich people, they don't want to change anything. Why should they? They have planet B. Oh, no, they have island B. So it is important. Also, family. Family is not just women. It's not just gender issues. I guess we have to frame it in the terms of family, because women are a part, or maybe the most important part of the family. So there are alternatives. And my last intervention, or my last thought, is maybe not politically correct, but all these transitions, they need money. They need financial support. So where should we get the money? Probably demilitarization is the key. We have to talk about demilitarization if we talk about peace. We cannot have both, I guess. And there's plenty of money there, but not just money. I mentioned pollution. I mentioned tensions. So degrowth, demilitarization, and more role to the women, that would be my vision for this future transition. So this would be my side. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lucka. This was, I think, a very wonderful introduction to our conversation, a very comprehensive one. And I very much liked also your emphasis on the challenges, but also the opportunities, because this is a situation in which we also have opportunities if we seize these opportunities. Technologies can be tools to moving our societies in directions that are more equal and at the same time more future-proof, in my view. Now, in international relations for a long time, environmental issues, developmental issues were kept quite neatly separate from political issues or security issues. This has to do with the setup in the United Nations, but it also has to do with the interests that underpin the different areas and actions. As of late, there has been a gradual coming together of some of these issues that have been kept separate for a long while. And increasingly, we understand that we need to come out of our silos and work across sectoral specializations and these political divides. So let me turn now to Alexandra Fong, Chief for Policy and Guidance at the United Nations Department of Political and Peacebuilding Affairs. Welcome, Alexandra, and please share with us a little bit what your department and what the UN, in a wider sense, has been trying to do in the last few years to address the topic that we have before us.
Thank you very much, Irene, and thanks to all of you. It's a real honor and a pleasure to be here. I would like to focus on two questions. First, what frameworks exist at the global level to address these growing linkages between climate, peace, and security? And second, what are the main priorities to translate those into action, which is really the focus of our discussion? The Secretary General has called the climate emergency a danger to peace. And this danger, of course, is not new. Countries from the Pacific have raised alarm over this at the UN a decade and a half ago. But I would argue that it has really been only in the last 5 or 6 years that frameworks have emerged at the global level to start addressing climate, peace, and security linkages, largely because more countries that are affected, that are on the front lines and are facing this double vulnerability, if you like, of climate and conflict, have joined the Pacific and spoken out demanding action. Take the UN Security Council, for example. Differences of opinion remain in the Council, but the Council today has recognized the adverse impacts of climate change in 13 country or regional contexts and has included language on climate in the mandates of several UN peace operations, which are based in highly climate vulnerable and conflict affected countries and regions such as West Africa, the Sahel, or the Middle East. Beyond the Security Council in New York, there is a group of friends on climate security, which had 12 members in 2018, and now counts 70 member states, 70, from all continents. And we also see regional organizations, such as the African Union, IGAD, the Pacific Island Forum, the European Union, OSCE, ASEAN, taking this agenda forward, and in many cases, leading the way. And very importantly, and I'm sure we'll get to this in the discussion, climate, peace, and security featured for the first time at COP. COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh and COP28 in Dubai. This is a very important signal of these worlds coming closer. Some have called it groundbreaking. Even as climate, peace, and security is still very much outside the formal negotiation track at COP. At the UN, we have set up a kind of new partnership called the Climate Security Mechanism, which is a sort of multidisciplinary effort because it brings together my department, the Department of Peace Operations, UNDP Development, and the UN Environment Programme in an effort to really bring different parts of the house together to address this very cross-cutting challenge of climate, peace, and security, to try and break out of the silos that you mentioned, Irene. And here we work with partners within the UN. The humanitarians are increasingly engaged, but also our human rights colleagues, our disaster risk reduction colleagues. It pretty much touches now on the mandates of the whole UN family. So we work with them, but also with partners beyond civil society and international researchers without whom we couldn't do this work. And now also thanks to donor support, this is all still extra budgetary largely, we've been able to deploy for the first time climate security advisors to some of our peace operations on the ground. So for the first time, we actually have dedicated technical capacity on the ground. And we're really grateful that Austria has joined our climate security mechanism as a partner. And I just want to say that none of this existed prior to 2017, 2018, really. So by UN standards, this is a very fast-moving agenda led by affected countries. And we now have frameworks, greater awareness, and I would say a better framing of the issue towards a shared vocabulary of climate, peace, and security, which, as you said, Irene and Lutschka, really also accentuates the opportunities for cooperation, not just the sort of doom and gloom and the focus on risks. So with these frameworks, what are some of the biggest priorities for action? From my point of view, I would like to quickly highlight five on which we have seen progress
but where we need to go much further. The first is to strengthen our capacity for integrated risk analysis. And this is because climate stressors interact with other factors, socioeconomic, demographic, political, in really complex non-linear ways. If you look at the Lake Chad Basin, for instance, you see how a web of environmental degradation, economic marginalization, and tensions between communities has eroded resilience of 45 million people, creating a multidimensional crisis. And successful prevention and response strategies really depend on a much more granular understanding of the context, and we really need to invest in this. And of course, this analysis has to be gender-informed. We know the heightened risks faced by women on climate risk, but also we know that women bring vital knowledge and environmental management skills to the table. Second priority, to build up the global evidence base. It's really data, data, data. Data is particularly scarce for conflict-affected, climate-vulnerable countries. We just don't have the data. And we need to deploy more innovative technologies to get this data. And I'm really pleased that tomorrow there's going to be the session on peace, tech, and data. I think this is a call to the research community, but also to tech-savvy young people, students that are rising and want to be engaged in this work. We need to build coalitions. We're trying to do this. In the Horn of Africa, for instance, the Secretary General's Special Envoy has created the first ever UN Climate Peace and Security Hub, which supports IGAD's new climate security coordination mechanism. So the two are working in partnership. And building up the evidence of what these risks look like in the region is key to this work. So a regional scoping study has just been completed. Also in the works is a mapping of potential solutions and of climate conflict and migration hotspots in the region. So an attempt to build up the evidence base and fill the libraries. Third priority, incorporate climate and environmental dimensions in good offices, preventive diplomacy, and mediation. This is difficult, but mediators today increasingly have to navigate the implications of climate change for peace. In West Africa and the Sahel, for example, where climate stressors have led to increasingly deadly clashes between herders and farmers, the UN is working with ECOWAS, member states, civil society, on good practices for conflict prevention and dispute resolution between communities that really try to factor in climate trends, promote inclusivity, and strengthen consultation. Fourth priority, to do the reverse, namely to integrate a conflict sensitivity lens in climate action and climate adaptation. This is important to avoid maladaptation, which can inadvertently increase conflict risks. And fifth, and that's my last one, I promise, is to really invest, and I think this will speak to many of you, in climate-sensitive peace building. The Secretary General has said repeatedly, including in his new Agenda for Peace, that climate action and peace building can and should reinforce each other. For this, of course, we need a breakthrough on climate adaptation and resilience, and we need greater flows of climate finance to conflict-affected countries, which currently receive only a tiny fraction of international climate finance flows. We are, of course, still far away from a breakthrough, but in the meantime, there are some really interesting, if small-scale, projects that show that it is possible to work on climate action, even in those very fragile contexts. The Peacebuilding Fund at the UN, which is our leading instrument for peacebuilding in those fragile contexts, has since 2016 or so invested almost $170 million in environmental peacebuilding projects. And a recent review of this investment points to three findings, and I just want to close with those. The first is go local. So local level engagement on environmental peace building may be one of the best areas, still complicated, but one of the most tractable in highly fragile contexts, as that can open up opportunities to address local sources of violence and strengthen local governance despite continuing volatility at the national level. So go local, and yes, this requires a certain risk tolerance. The second is bet on the catalytic effect. So even small investments can serve as a conversation starter or a tugboat, if you will, to draw larger attention and focus of larger donor money to environmental peace building. And a lot can be done to scale small projects and align them better with World Bank and other efforts. And then the third one is go for those co-benefits. Responding to climate change, as we've heard, can create opportunities to build trust, confidence and collaboration across various divides, like women's exclusion or elite capture in local communities. And in Yemen, for instance, a project in two governorates helped institutionalize women's role in water user associations, which had a lot of co-benefits because it increased women's participation, it increased peace building, and it improved the management of natural resources. So a lot more needs to be done, but those co-benefits are out there, and we have to show that this can work in order to galvanize the action that we so desperately need. So thank you very much, and I look forward to hearing to my co-panelists, and of course from all of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alexandra. Thank you also for pointing out to us that we don't have to wait for the overarching solution or the $1 billion fund to fall from I don't know where in order to start. We can start even with small sums. We can start locally, and it does show benefits. So it is these are approaches that can be scaled into time. Let me now turn to the more regional situations after we've heard these two excellent introductions from a more global perspective. Let me introduce to you Aisha Al-Sarihi. She is coming from Oman, but her work has brought her to Singapore. And she is an associate fellow in the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. And in preparing for this conversation, we have said that you will speak a little bit about the Middle Eastern region, which is the region where your expertise is most profound. Please, you have the floor.
Well, thank you very much, Irene, and thanks to co-panelists as well. So, yes, my research has been focused on studying the impacts of the climate change in the Middle East. And perhaps the Middle East region, Middle East and North Africa, is where we see the impacts of the climate change more pronounced, and especially those related to the conflict and the security issues. The Middle East is one of the most vulnerable regions to the impacts of the climate change. Even though the global warming is a global phenomenon, for the Middle East, the region is heating as twice faster compared to the other parts of the world. Temperature records of 50 degrees Celsius is now becoming a norm. It has been witnessed in different countries in the region, in Kuwait, in UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, and it's becoming more frequent now. Water scarcity is a major challenge for the Middle East and North Africa. For me, coming to Austria and through the bus from the airport to here, you look around and you see water, you see clouds, you see water streams on the sides, green trees, and you can tell, like, there's water. But if you visit the Middle East, you look around and then you see brown. It is an arid climate environment, and then you ask where the water come from. So the water scarcity is a major challenge for the region. Most countries in the region are below the renewable water scarcity annual threshold of 1,000 cubic meter per capita per year. And there are 13 countries in the regions where they are below the absolute water scarcity threshold of 500 cubic meter per capita per year. Another challenge, so we have less water, and then at the same time, the region also, because of the climate change, experience floods, so heavy rainfall, and also cyclones are becoming frequent in the region. Droughts, elongated periods of drought, is also another challenge. And so the impacts of the climate change are adding an additional layer to already existing vulnerability and conflict issues in the region. They are also playing a role in creating new tension and conflict-related challenges in the region. Examples include, if we start with Iran first, because of the water shortages, Iran now frequently experiences protests because water is important for the generation of the electricity in Iran, so people protest because of the electricity blackout, and that is actually goes because there's water shortages. Syria, the Syrian civil war actually happened after a long period of a drought in the country. In Yemen, before the war, there are records of tension over groundwater resources, which caused the killing between people. But now, because of the war, the country is not able to adapt to, you know, the and doesn't have the resilience because of the damage to the infrastructure and the economy overall. Tunisia perhaps is a prominent example. It is because of the rise of the food prices in Tunisia in 2011 that caused the spread out of a protest around the region, or so-called the Arab Spring. And as I mentioned, climate issues also are not going to be felt within the national borders of countries, but because natural resources are shared between countries, especially water, as mentioned by the professor, in the region around more than 66% of surface water originate from outside the national borders of the countries. And examples include the Jordan River Basin, the Nile River, Euphrates and Tigris, Senegal River Basin. It is also countries shared the groundwater and the water from the aquifers, and that includes the basalt aquifer system between Jordan and Syria. There is another system between Oman and the UAE, Jordan and Saudi Arabia, another one, the Nubian sandstone between Chad, Egypt, Libya, and Sudan. And of course, we all heard about the tension between Egypt and Ethiopia, because Ethiopia started to build the dam, and it claims the dam is for the economic development. But the concern for Egypt is the reduced flow of the water, and more than 70% of the laborers in Egypt depend on the agriculture for their income. So, and also, the more than 40% of internally displaced people are from the Middle East. And, of course, all of those factors coming together, we will see more and more, especially when they are actually interacting with existing conflict, the wars that are taking place in the region. So with that, I want to highlight on a few initiatives. So the countries in the regions are aware of those challenges. And then there are initiatives like joint authorities, especially around shared water resources. There is a joint authority between Egypt and Libya around the Nubian sandstone aquifer. Iraq and Syria also try to regulate the quantity of water around Euphrates. Egypt and Sudan also around the Nile River. So Egypt and Sudan, excluding Ethiopia, which is not really helping in solving the issue. And these initiatives have started back in 1950s and 1980s and 1990s. So a long while ago, but we still see the tension. We still see the conflict going on. And I think the reason behind that goes back beyond the long-running social and religious disagreements, that long history of disagreement. And also, these agreements, or the joint of the examples that I mentioned, most of them are not designed to capture the basin overall. So not all of the countries around the basin are involved. It is, for example, for the Nile, we have Sudan and Egypt, excluding Ethiopia, where the water actually originates. And then also the matter of trust between countries. Also looking at those initiatives, there are no formal documents and guidance on how the cooperation could happen. Also what is missing is we don't have a mechanism to look after any kind of dispute that happens. So being in Singapore at the moment, I also look at how the ASEAN countries come together to look after shared natural resources. They have a kind of mediator. So whenever there's a dispute, they have a channels for discussion. So they put that ahead of any kind of consequences that could happen. And then also there are sub-regional climate issues that need sub-regional initiative, and that is lacking. Like, for example, in North Africa, there's missing sub-regional climate initiatives. With that, I will stop here, and I'm happy to take questions from you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, dear Aisha. I think you gave us a very good insight into what is happening in a very crucial area for our topic. Professor Lukcha pointed out in her slides how water stressed these regions are and how obvious the connection there to conflict is. Let me now turn to Mamadou Bodian. Thank you very much, Mamadou, for joining our panel. You literally were asked yesterday at midnight or something like that, because the foreseen fourth a panelist could not travel here for urgent personal reasons. So thank you very much for agreeing to being on this panel. You come to us from Senegal. You are with the University Cheikh Anta Diop in Dakar, and you are also with the SRG, which is a specialized group to study the issue at hand. I'm also very happy that you are with us as a man, because the topic of peace and environment is a topic that concerns humanity. And it's wonderful to have such a strong female panel. So often in conferences, you know, females are underrepresented, but we're very happy to have you with us, with your knowledge and with your perspective from Western Africa. Please share a little bit of what is happening in that region of the world.
Thank you so much, Irene, for this introduction, and I'm very delighted to be part of this panel and to share my thoughts on a very, very relevant topic on climate change, peace and security, which is very relevant to the Sahel region, which, as you know, is acting as a natural divider between the Sahara Desert to the north and the tropical savanna to the south, but also spanning from the Atlantic Ocean to the Red Sea. So it's a very huge area which is affected by climate fragilities, but also hazards. But there's something interesting about this region. It's also one of the fast-growing population. It has recorded one of the fast-growing population, with almost 64.5% of the population below the age of 25. So which means that it's a very young population striving to make a living, but also experiencing various sort of pressure to get job, to access to employment, but also access to basic infrastructure. And unfortunately, the economic sector is dominated by agriculture and livestock, with 60% of the population being employed in the agricultural sector, which also contributes to 40% of the GDP in the Sahel region. And rain-fed agriculture is highly susceptible to climate vulnerability and form today the bulk of the economic sector. And of course, the situation leaves the economy vulnerable to climate change. As you know, just to convey some figures from scientists, you know, temperatures are raising 1.5 times faster than the global average. And this also have consequences in terms of intense droughts. And this region having experiencing a series of droughts since the 1970s, which also put the population in a very difficult situation when it's come to getting access to food, but also erratic rainfalls, which also destroy crops and fields, let alone all this struggling livelihood. But it's also the acceleration of land degradation and deforestation, which is now one of the main threats, especially in countries like Mauritania, but also Niger, and today, the central Sahel region, it's kind of Niger, Mali, and Burkina are one of the hot spots where climate and security are being intermingled and creating an ecosystem of violence, which also leave this region vulnerable. And Francophone Sahel also is part of this, you know, big area where all these issues I mentioned earlier are also concentrated and converged. And it is known today for becoming one of the area where food insecurity is food security is threatened. Why? Because agricultural productivity is becoming low, and this also affect commodity raising prices, but also violence over resources, access to resources, and this also have consequences in terms of increasing the number of internally displaced people, because people don't have access to land, you know, water, especially for pastoralists, water resources are becoming rare. And this also affects patterns of migration, transhumance, and accelerate also tensions between herders and farmers. And I'm going to emphasize this issue of the relationship between climate change, conflict, and how they are connected. Of course, in the Sahel region, we can see how these issues are interconnected. And they manifest themselves into three different ways, one of them being resource depletion, which have kind of also a trend, a relationship between farmers and herders, as I mentioned. And Central Mali is an example because farmers and herders have been living for centuries and has developed rules and regulations that also help diffuse tensions. But with this insecurity situation with the state beating retreat, it has left these communities without any possibility to... it left a sort of security vacuum with people trying to organize themselves into militias, but also some sort of armed group. And this has also accelerated tensions over resources, scarce resources, access to forests, but also with herders who have been disadvantaged by public policies over the last few years, took advantage of this security situation to arm themselves, but also to enter a kind of conflict with anyone who wants to prevent them from using resources. And it also created a possibility or an opportunity for some Islamic groups. Kufa is known for being one of these leading figures who also come with a powerful narrative that also strengthened the herder community by saying, well, resources belongs to God, so everyone can use them at will. So this resonates among these Fulani, but also herders people who find themselves empowered. So we can see how this conflict dynamic, but also conflict over resources, are being instrumentalized by some groups who try to call for a new authority that also challenges the authority of the state. But there's also conflict over land, and I'm not going to go into how this kind of scarcity of water, pasture, and fertile soil are also forcing people to migrate. And today, this conflict can be felt in hosting communities, and I think CPRI has done a very interesting with the Danish Refugee Council on conflict affecting hosting communities and internal displaced people in some areas, including in the Tillaberi region, but also in some parts of Burkina Faso, the northern part. So we can see how conflict also, because people don't have access to remote fields and lands. So, and there is a competition, but also pressure over the remaining fertile lands, which also increase possibilities of tensions. The second thing that I want to emphasize is how climate change also impacts agriculture and the economy as a whole. I'm not talking about the agro-pastoral economy, which is now one of the main sector that is affected by climate, and as you know, it provides cattle is very important for the economy because it provides meat to the market, but also it also represents a sort of wealth for some people who don't necessarily sell their cattle. That's their bank. That's their good, right? If they sell, it's just to get some cash to buy something else, but I think overall that's their good. But today we've seen, for example, how this kind of climate change, but also consequences on agriculture, is depriving people from their main activity, but also creating opportunity for new criminal activities. And cattle rustling has become one of the kind of very lucrative business, with people kind of capturing cattle from Fulani and selling them, crossing the border and selling them. So this is a kind of consequence of all these changes happening, and that are also affecting conflict patterns. So, and the third one, and I will conclude, is, and I also mentioned it a little bit, it's basically how armed groups are taking advantage of people's vulnerability to recruit them, but also to position themselves as new authorities who provide security services, And we've seen this with Kufa, but also I think it's ethnic militias, which are becoming more and more emerging actors who provide security in return of, you know, what they call racket, protection racket. So it has also become one of the main activity that is evolving in parallel to legal activities. And it also adds another layer of complexity in this already complex situation. So to conclude, a few recommendations. So I agree with Alexandra that we need to address the structural and local drivers of conflict. So going local is, for me, very important in a bottom-up approach to tackling these issues of climate can yield very interesting results, because people also have developed some resilience, mechanism for resilience, that, you know, interveners may not necessarily value. And I think it's good to include local people who have been experiencing these issues for many years, and who have also, so now the issue is how to expand those experiences and make them more inclined to develop more resilience. There is another question, maybe I don't know how to answer it, but how to keep funding programs that improve climate adaptation in fragile or conflict-affected areas? That's a big topic. I know that there's been experiences, maybe tapping into all these positive experiences would be very helpful. And the last one is, we know that conflict in the Sahel are rooted in political governance related weaknesses. So how to effectively improve governance to mitigate and prevent climate related conflict? And I think that's a big issue that also is a responsibility to states in the Sahel region. So this is what I wanted to share, the thought to this topic. And thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Hamadou. Thank you very much for your perspective as well. First of all, is there anything that any of the panelists would like to react to in what other panelists have said? Any comments, any questions for clarification that you wish to raise to each other?
Maybe one question to Aisha about water scarcity in this area. In your opinion, are there technological solutions to actually try to mitigate this problem, or is it not possible? Because when we talk international aid, this is could be idea how to help these countries, but with the technology, is it feasible? I'm not sure.
The region has already moved to use the technology, actually. So the major sources of water, it is either surface water resources or groundwater. So now what happens, there is a growth of population, expansion of industries, overconsumption of the water. And so the groundwater, which used to be the main source of fresh water in the region, now it's kind of like exploited, and because of that exploitation of the water, the sea water is actually intruding, so it is salinated. And of course, climate change increased the rate of evaporation of the water, and then also it combines with the reduced rainfall generally. So no longer the groundwater is a dominant source of fresh water supply. In the Gulf region, in Oman, where I came from, and Saudi Arabia, the UAE, now the desalination is a major source of fresh water. Now the question is whether this is the desalination is a sustainable pathway of producing water. The current technology is a thermal technology for desalination, which means that it needs fuel to operate the plant for the desalination, and it mainly requires either oil and gas. Yeah. So, And then the other environmental challenge is the brine water that is also released. Nowadays it goes to the seawater, and that is actually not good for the fisheries and the marine environment. And the Gulf countries actually are aware, because it's not only the desalination, it is other sectors which also needs fuel, like the oil and gas. So there is an increasing demand domestically, even though these countries are major importers for the oil and gas. So the governments are well aware that there's an issue here. We need to reduce the consumption of the oil and gas domestically. So in the desalination front, now they are trying to move to more efficient technology, which is the reverse osmosis technology. Okay. Oman has started to implement this technology. They are also exploring the opportunity of using renewable energy as a source of energy for water desalination. So yes, technology is the way forward, but as I mentioned also, like, the region experience heavy rainfalls, yeah. And in a very frequent manner. So one way also, like, building dams. So we don't have, like, rivers. We have dry rivers which flow only when there is a heavy rain. So they build dams to trap the water, use it, for example, for electricity generation or for the agriculture. It is the way to refill the aquifers with water. So, yes, so the technology is the way forward, but, of course, there are trade-offs that needs to be taken into account.
I guess, yes, because technology, some people just believe that technology can solve everything, but I guess...
Yeah, just one comment or one question to you, Mr. Fong. It's very nice the UN moves in the right direction, but there's a question of, do we have the time? Because, you know, we have to be in terms of at least mitigating climate change, but 2030 already cutting emissions by 60%, or 250, because UN is so slow, sorry to say that, but how can we accelerate? Because if we start collecting data now, you know, after, you cannot collect data 1 year, you should collect, I don't know, 5 years, and then analyze them. Time is not waiting for that. So are there any quicker ways to go?
So, Alexander, please.
I mean, it's maybe not so question, but observation that we don't have time for...
I think it's not a question to Alexandra, really, because she agrees that time is running out. It's probably a call for urgent action by everybody, right? The UN, but everybody... who has any leverage on the question, and that's really every one of us. Let me also, as we continue the conversation here at the panel, let me also open it up very much to all of you. We have microphones available for you. If you wish to make a point, raise a question, do so. I see two hands already from three.
Thank you, and congratulations to the brilliant panel. I'm Babacar Ndiaye from Timbuktu Institute in Senegal. I have one short comment and two questions. The one relates to water scarcity and hydro diplomacy. To say this area, really, Senegal could raise its flag very high. By starting in 1972 already, establishing an organization to manage the Senegalese river basin water with Mali, Mauritania, and Senegal, which really contributed to good neighborliness, development with energy, but also peace in the area. I think the Danube was established in 1999, I think, yes. I believe. I think that should be taken as a model, and that's very good. And number the second question is on desalination. Whatever we think about the technology, great solution, but we generally forget the new problem the solution is going to create. My question to scientists is, desalination is the sexy thing now. What is the long-term implications for the marine ecosystem? That's really something that I'm very concerned about. The second one is the nexus, democracy and environment. Today, the key question is liberal versus liberal democracy. It's a driving force of all the conflict you see, the Sahel and the world. I heard one brilliant presentation by Professor Ben Ansel, Oxford University, on the force of democracy versus illiberal democracy. He argues that democracy, despite all the odds, internally, externally, has better clean water, better environment than illiberal. I think that would be interesting to see if science could prove, given evidence to that. And my final question is the nexus, climate change and peace, but also crime. Peace is state security. In the Sahel, human security is critical, but it's not never high on the level. In the Sahel, because of lack of opportunity and poverty, crime is becoming an economic opportunity. In migrant smuggling, human trafficking, gold mining, and the rest of it. I think it would be interesting to see also that. That would be my final question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let us collect those three statements from the persons who raised their please, go ahead.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for the very insightful presentations. I think my intervention is more of a comment than a question, and that has to do with the fact that I think it is significant that we denaturalize climate insecurity by asking the question how all these insecurities have come about in the first instance, what the differential implications have been or continue to be, because I think it is a fact that often climate insecurity, much as it's a global phenomenon, the implications for, you know, societies in different parts of the world differ. So what has been the differential impact on people? And this question is important because I think we would all recognize the fact that even though countries, particularly in African countries in Africa have contributed the least to greenhouse emissions, but they continue to bear the brunt of climate insecurities. And related to this is also, therefore, the need to go beyond the immediacy of conflict, because until we understand how all of this is coming, or all of this have come about, and to underpin the philosophies that inform climate responses, then we will be going in cycles, you know, coming back to this. So for me, I think it is important that we ask those fundamental questions to inform how we respond to climate insecurities. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for all of you, for the international perspective, but also for the regional perspective and the UN perspective. I have two questions. The first one relates a little bit to yours. I mean, do you really think that democracy and degrowth are compatible concepts? Now, I fear a little bit in the global West, at least, for, I mean, loss of democracy. So I'm really a little bit afraid that these two concepts of degrowth, as you said, and democracy is not compatible. So do we sacrifice democracy in the global West? Question mark. The second one goes to Alexandra, maybe. I totally agree with you that, I mean, we have a time problem here. But there, unless I overheard it, nobody mentioned SDGs. Now, climate, if I recall correctly, I mean, is part of the SDGs. Why do we have duplicating structures now? We have COP on the one hand as a kind of technical-political institution, but why do we duplicate? There are two institutions or two concepts. One is SDGs, which comprises climate, and the second one is the Summit of the Future to operationalize. Looking at the last draft of the Summit of the Future document, it's a, well, menu type disarmament, whatever, peace, security, climate appears on page, I don't know where, somewhere also. However, yes, why are these instruments not used like Summit of the Future to operationalize like this conference does climate, peace and security, if it's so urgent, and then rally the other topics around? Thank you.
Thank you. I take the fourth comment.
Okay. Angela Kane, I'm a board member of the Austrian Forum for Peace, and I also, like Martin, have spent a lot of time at the UN, so that question already is taken care of, but I have two other questions, very quick. The first is, you haven't talked at all about aquifers, and I think the depletion of the aquifers is really important. I mean, not only the developing world, but everywhere all over the world. I mean, whether it's in the US or whatever, and that is something like there's no solution that I can see at all as to how this is going to be unless we get more rain. And the other question that I have is the IPCC is so respected as a panel. It's a scientific panel. It's never criticized from what I can hear. And I wonder whether it wouldn't be possible for you to also be heard at like the G20, the BRICS, the G7, at these major meetings where I think these voices are absolutely need to be heard, and they're not. And that is something that I find very, very regrettable. And the last point I wanted to make is, what do you think about the lawsuits that are now appearing by young people to basically challenge governments to sort of say, you need to do X, Y, Z, because otherwise we don't have a future?
Let me just ask Damita, we started a little late. Can we take a few minutes?
You have 15 minutes max.
15 yes. minutes max. Excellent. So we have a little time. So let us perhaps take those four comments back to the panelists.
I can comment on the first question.
Yes,
about desalinization.
Yeah. Whoever wishes to comment on whatever question can do.
That's so easy, because it's a technical question. And the problem is that people see drinking water as the major water problem. But drinking water represents only maybe 10% of the water needed for economic development. So agriculture is the problem with water, industry, energy production, because even in Europe with heat waves we have this breaking up because the nuclear power plants cannot cool. So desalinization is, of course, with the renewable energy price is not too high, is a part of solution, but the problem, water problem, will remain, because agriculture, irrigation is the problem, and the industry. Economic growth is thirsty, so it's not drinking water at all. Mm-hmm. Regarding maybe the should we sacrifice democracy? It's a very hard question from one coming from the field of physics, but we call it climate crisis. So in times of crisis, we have to save lives. I will never one city in the Europe. I will not name it for the floods in the capital. And some people didn't want to move. This is my home, I will stay here. So a lot of people suffered from the flooding because they could not react. So they changed the constitution. In times of crisis, other rules apply. So if we have a common understanding that we cannot eliminate democracy forever, but to solve the crisis, maybe we should sacrifice it. I mean, I know it's harsh to say, but otherwise we don't have time. So,
yeah. But this connection between environmental issues, climate change as a challenge, and the social fabric of our societies and the social justice issues in our societies, the distribution issues in our societies, I think they are coming to the fore, and they are more and more we understand the interconnectedness better and better. And perhaps if we act also on the social dimension of the climate change challenge, perhaps then we can also increase the buy-in from wider groups of the population for climate action. You know, because most people act rationally, and And we know from a recent poll, for example, in Austria, that the average Austrian understands very well that climate change impacts differently on different groups of society. And, you know, so building on this understanding that is there already, perhaps the integration of the social dimension and the environmental dimension and the conflict prevention dimension could be a way forward as well. But there are other... Please, go ahead.
Yeah, maybe just to answer in the same time with this comment also about IPCC role. The problem is that we are trying to establish this process of change since 1992. It was the first report of IPCC showing exactly what is the reality now. So we were not wrong, but you know, it's inconvenient for politicians to hear that. It's inconvenient message. That is why we are heard, you know, but we are not publicly, I should say, put as an I don't know the prevailing fact. People are running away from truth. This is the problem, and also maybe. If we talk about inequalities, if we talk about things, they were building up since the last Second World War. It's not something new. And sometimes I feel like, politicians, decision makers, are using climate change as an excuse. Like this, things would turn differently, but we have climate change now. And this is a dangerous position. I think
as Minister Gewessler said yesterday, you know, climate change is being used as a captured by political parties to actually fuel polarization,
exactly.
Instead of using it as a rallying point where everybody has to work together as you would in a national crisis. There you overcome the divisions.
Maybe just the last comment from my side. I want other panelists to speak as well. You said people usually act rationally. Yes, they do, but the problem is there's still a problem of education about climate change. Older politicians, they did not learn about climate change in school. A lot of decision makers either. I think that after you really know what is going on, then you act rationally. Without real knowledge, you are informed by, I don't know, fake news TikTok or whatever.
True.
And this is not a basis for rational behavior. So as a professor, I know that there's a lot to be done on that field. Climate change literacy, climate change education at all levels, not just in primary school.
Other panelists may wish to react. Yes, please go ahead, Mamoru.
Yes, I just want to jump on the question of democracy in relation to this ecological awareness, and I think it's very important to think about how democracy can foster a debate over issues that also engage people's life and create a framework that allows even minority voices who are concerned about the future of the planet, the future of their communities in relation to everything related to climate change to be heard, but also to take action by getting involved in politics and making sure that they have also the possibility of climbing their way up to the decision-making spheres and to put in motion those kind of policies. And that's what we are seeing happening in many West African countries, including in Senegal, where these ecolos are kind of becoming more and more important, and they're kind of rallying people, taking actions at the local level, but also involving grassroots organizations to make small changes. You can have that in a dictatorship. You can have that in a military rule. And I think that's where the strength of democracy lies. So fostering democracy is also creating a space that allows other people to have the possibility to voice concern, including those who are aware of the risk associated with environmental issues and climate. So that's the kind of contribution I wanted to kind of answer into Njai's question.
Mm-hmm. Any other... Alexander, did you want? Yeah?
Maybe just briefly on regional approaches, hydro diplomacy, etc. I think it's really important that the global level tries to catch up now with the regional and the local level, where so much knowledge exists on hydro diplomacy, but also coping strategies. And I think the real challenge about climate peace and security is it's so cross-cutting, but you also have to try and connect the global, the regional, the national, the subnational, all the way down to the local. It's extraordinarily difficult to do this, but it has to be a kind of two-way street of building knowledge and trying to come up with solutions. And then maybe just to say that on the time issue, I couldn't agree more. I think the Secretary General and others have been very, very vocal about time running out and also the need for climate justice at the core of all of this. We have 193 member states, some of whom are major emitters and others are not. So there are obviously a lot of dynamics around that. I think it's very clear that the best prevention strategy is mitigation. But while we push for better, faster mitigation, as you say, Professor, we also have to, I think, be cognizant of the communities and countries that are already impacted by climate disruption. So in a way, having to do both is a challenge. And maybe also just to say that on the duplication question, you're right, duplication, we have too few resources to duplicate. You could look at it a different way also, that it's not so much duplication, hopefully, but if this is the defining challenge of our time, then shouldn't we have every multilateral forum engaged? So whether it's the COP process, whether it's the Security Council, the General Assembly, ECOSOC, part of the SDGs, each with their own comparative advantage to move this forward, ideally avoiding duplication, but somehow breaking out of silos and building connecting tissues. And yes, we are looking forward to the Summit of the Future to really provide impetus to many of these issues. Thank you.
I'll take two more. The gentleman here go ahead, Marlies, and then okay. The gentleman is the concluding.
Thank you very much. Marlies Stubitz, Land Burgenland, and also in the capacity of a professor for international law. Thank you very much to all the panelists for highly informative and very inspiring contributions. I have two remarks and questions. I would like to continue with Angela's remark when it comes to G20 and other fora on the global level. What is needed in order to make them aware that you should and must be invited and they have a responsibility? I come also from the finance sector, and it was they were very quick, extremely quick, in forming up after the financial crisis when it came to the issue of global financial stability. But when it comes to a much more important question on how our globe will survive, they are not at all there. So what is needed in order to get them awake? And the second question to you, Alexandra, I remember working on sustainable finance that Kofi Annan in 2006 presenting the responsible business conduct, and a lot of international companies, multinationals, he brought together, and then also the green finance, green economy idea was developed and later also in the European Union taken up. Of course, it is a business model, but on the other hand, I wonder about the responsibility of multinationals. So especially when you talk about the agricultural sector, we have big companies, multinationals like Cargill. They have a turnover in 2022, about 170 billion euros. We have a lot of other IT and tech companies worldwide. What is their responsibility? How are they brought into the pipeline? How are they brought on the table? And next to our countries, to politicians, what they have to do in order to fight that challenge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Marlies. And the last comment from the gentleman here.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you for all your presentation. And I have just two questions. one for Professor Luca and the second one for Alexandra. The first, you said in your presentation about the human population growth. You didn't mention Africa, which is the population will be grown between 2020 to 2050 by 2.5 billion by 2025. We talking about time, the running time. We don't have time. The time is gone. Let's be realistic. The time is gone. Every year we meeting at COP26, COP25, 27, 28, but we talking the same things and no action. Let us go straight. What action that we need to save those 2.5 billion by 2050? Yeah. Straight away. Mm-hmm. No speeches, no talking, straight to action.
No discussion.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for this.
This is the first question. Can I go to the second straight?
Quickly.
Okay.
Yeah, because we're running.
We think Alexandra is saying about the plan of the United Nations, about the global data, technologies, security advice has been in Africa, and we're seeing like too many money will be invested in many activities, such as climate change, security, and conflict between the herders and farmers. Where this money gone? We didn't see any money. Because most of African countries, United Nations not working with the local NGO. That's the big problem. Because the local NGO, they knows very well the reality of the conflict. And sometimes when the United Nations funding a project with the local NGO, they are not in deep funding. Like they can get some line of the budget of the project, but they're not funding like officially. And this is very issues that can create more conflict in Africa. The one more thing that you mentioned about the Mutual new project that regrouped 13 countries in West and Sahel Africa. Can you just a bit more clarify in which countries are exactly you going to funding or you going to elaborate more contribution with these 13 countries?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Since time is very, very limited now, I would suggest that, Alexandra, you continue that conversation on the particular project, perhaps directly with the gentleman after mm-hmm. we conclude here. I would like to invite the panelists to react to the two comments from the audience as they desire to. And then I would like to ask everybody on the panel just for one word that might take us forward, and then we need to conclude. So who would like to react to Marlis's question? I think, Alexandra, you were perhaps addressed about the transnational corporations thing.
I think it's an excellent question. I don't think I'm the right person to answer. I mean, we in the political department of the UN aren't climate experts or climate finance experts. We come at this very much from a conflict prevention perspective. So for us, the learning curve has been incredibly steep, and it's part of breaking through the silos and having a multidisciplinary approach. So on the multinationals, I would defer to other panelists, except to say that I think it's very clear that private money is going to be absolutely critical in the larger effort of climate action, but increasingly also in the area of peace building. So I think that would be what I could say on mm-hmm. on that front. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Maybe just a comment upon negotiations that are frustrating for many scientists as well. The problem is that we need to solve the climate change problem with cooperation, and developing countries are really not to blame for the past. And what, in my view, is climate justice, that actually we have to compensate our global north or global west, however we call it, developed countries. We have to admit our historical guilt.
and not just to admit it, but also to finance. And science today can really calculate how much does UK owe to India, how much does Germany owe to, I don't know. It can be calculated in theory, but we need politicians to negotiate around that numbers, how many billions. And in that case, I guess we will get developing countries aboard to do, especially, I'm not talking so much about Africa, but about Asian countries. Mm. It can be calculated now, really. 10 years ago, it was not possible, but science has advanced in that field. Regarding human population growth depends on women, not on men. I hope you understand that. And my grandmother, she had 7 brothers, 7 sisters. My mother already went to faculty, got a job. So I was an only child, and I also the one. So it happened naturally in Europe. Even it happened that we are lacking, actually, children. So invest in in women education, this is one. Invest in health system in these countries, this is not so expensive. And invest in pension system, because many children are born to this world because women are afraid who will take care of me when I'm old. So pension system, health system, education, and it can be done in 15 years.
All right, a last word from everybody. A last word that will lead forward. Let me start with you, Aisha. You have been quiet in this round of comments. Let me ask you to kick this final round off.
Yes, perhaps from the perspective of the Middle East, what is the starting point of the change? I think the economic incentives is the starting point for the change. In the Middle East, the water, the electricity, and other services are pretty much highly subsidized, so the people are used to have access to cheap electricity and water. So on the question also on the aquifers, how we can manage that, actually, it is the demand side more than the supply side. We need to change the behavior. And that would, from my point of view, would only happen through the economic incentives where we put a real price on the water that reflects the cost of the production of that water or electricity.
Thank you. Thank you. This was a bit more than one word, but I think it was very, very well taken. Very well taken. Very well taken. Thank you very much.
Okay, my word would be cooperation, but not just in political field, but also in the scientific field. Today, just saying I'm not a climate change expert, I'm an economic person that doesn't. We have to learn more, because we have to understand the language of each other, and then we can cooperate, really. So cooperation in science
cooperation.
As well.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, you mentioned something very interesting. It's the economic model is the root cause of these ecological problems. And the question is how to create a framework that allows, for example, you know, the global north, which is a big player into this problem, to discuss, but also find concrete solutions in collaboration with the global south, which is...
On a new economic model.
Absolutely.
Yeah, of course.
The global south, which is affected by all these problems we're talking about.
Yeah. Thank you. Alexander.
So, a lot of good words have been taken, and I fully agree. So my fourth would be solidarity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Well, let me thank you. You have been a wonderful panel. Each one of you has made a great contribution. I'm not attempting to summarize it. I will be hard-pressed to find a short summary for Thursday, but I will work on it. It was a very rich conversation. It's not ending here. It is starting. It will continue through the coffee breaks and the other encounters that you have here. I encourage the interaction of all of you very much. And I also would like to thank you, our distinguished audience. And I close this session. Back to you.
Thank you so much, Irene, and thank you also to our speakers for this inspiring panel. A few organizational words. Once again, we are a little late, so the coffee break that Irene just mentioned, I'm afraid I have to take that away from you. Please make your way immediately to the workshop rooms, and coffee will be served there. If you are joining the hackathon, your seminar room is a little bit further away, and you have Nathan Coyle waiting right here to take you there with him, so please find him. Lunch is at 12:30 in the courtyard. Irrespective of your workshop, please make your way to the courtyard at 12:30 so you don't go hungry. And after lunch, the workshops will continue in the rooms they started in. Thank you.